Case 94 from the Book of Serenity. Dongshan is unwell. Introduction. The lower do not discuss the higher. The base do not move the noble. Even if you can control yourself and follow others, you still cannot toil at the heavy by means of the light. When the physical elements are out of tune, how does one attend and nurture? The main case. When Dongshan was unwell, a monk asked, "You are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill?" Dongshan said, "There is." The monk said, "Does the one who is not ill look after you?" Dongshan said, "I have the opportunity to look after him." The monk said, "How is it when you look after him?" Dongshan said, "Then I don't see that he has any illness." And the verse, taking off the smelly skin bag, casting away the mass of red flesh, directly the nose is straight. Immediately the skull is dry. The old doctor doesn't see the indigestion from before. The little one looks in on him, but it's hard to approach. When the meadow streams are thin, the autumn ponds recede. Where the white clouds end, the old mountains are cold. You must cut off absolutely. Don't be big-headed. Evolving to the utmost effortlessness, he attains to the state. The lone standout is not in the same class as you. So the fans remind me of when I was, I believe, 8 years old, and my brother and I shared a bedroom. We had seen once in cartoons how you could feed spaghetti into the back of the fan, and it would spray in a wondrous way. So we found some dry spaghetti in the cabinet. And had a wonderful afternoon. We were very careful, of course, and no one lost any fingers. But the spaghetti spread all over the room. And eventually my mother came in and said, "What's going on here?" And then we were in trouble. So here we are feeding dry spaghetti into the back of the fan, the fan of the mind, all kinds of messes happening, all kinds of disturbances, all kinds of unwell arising. This basic unwellness, the Buddha called it the first noble truth. The first noble truth, this starting point of being human. Of course, from one perspective, it is such a problem. I am such a problem. I train and train and still the same old me. The reactiveness appears, certainty of separation, this human delusion that there are two parts of the world. There is me and my inner world, and there is everything else. A friend of Melissa and mine is a poet, and I think it's a line from one of her poems where she says, we float through heaven in a bubble of hell. How sweet. we make it so difficult. And this is the good news. This very body, this very trouble, is the entry point. Without disturbance, there is no possibility. So we are all disturbed. We are all deeply disturbed here. And for some reason, we think it's a good idea to disturb ourselves further. So we sign up for the retreat. Seemed like a good idea. And then find the one who is unwell. And of course, at first, we want to simply fix this one. It seems like an easy matter. I'll just tidy up this corner and straighten up that. Mom won't notice the spaghetti all over the floor. It'll be fine. But of course, it's not fine. It's so deeply not fine. And we all carry this aching in our heart. And yesterday Josh spoke so movingly about this ache and about the possibility of, rather than trying to protect and limit, to open and expand. This is the direction of our practice, straight forward into the heart of life, this bloody, beating, suffering, celebrating heart. And our vow, our bodhisattva vow, to save all beings. In the Diamond Sutra, the Buddha talks about saving all beings, that this is how we become bodhisattvas, by saving all beings. And in the wonderful Indian tradition, there's a long list of including waterborne and airborne and earthborne, including those with legs and without legs, including those flying and those swimming and those slithering. Including those with consciousness and without consciousness, including everything, saving all beings. And then he goes on to say, if you think there are any beings outside of you, then you are deeply mistaken. And so this is quite a tender teaching. This teaching that all beings are us, because on one hand we can then put up a wall and say, oh, it's all me, so I don't have to worry, it's all me, it's all here, no problem. And so this story of Dongshan made me think of Dongshan, who's a Chan ancestor who lived in the 9th century and is considered one of the founders of the Soto tradition, and one of the great texts of our Soto heritage. We read this morning the Song of the Jeweled Mirror Samadhi. This was written by Dongshan. So this same one, we have the story at the end of his life, and then we recite his words this morning, this jeweled mirror samadhi. And he says, facing a precious mirror, form and reflection behold each other. You are not it, but in truth it is you. So facing a precious mirror. What a wonderful image for our practice. What a wonderful image for our life. This great round mirror of life that reflects, that effortlessly reflects whatever is brought before it. When blue comes, blue is reflected. When joy comes, joy is reflected. When shit comes, shit is reflected. Uchiyama Roshi said that everything you encounter is yourself. So there is one who is unwell. Who is there one who is not unwell? Yes, there is. And so who is this other? In the middle of Back on Fire, in the middle of almost toppling over on your neighbor out of sleepiness, in the middle of not knowing where to go or where to turn, where is this other? We might say, where is this awakened nature that we hear about? Where is the one who has no problem? This other, if we say, it's just me, then we fall into this grave mistake. This mistake of imagining that it is all up to you. This fallacy of imagining that you are creating your life. The fallacy that you are breathing your breath. The fallacy that you are thinking your thoughts. Of course, our language makes us believe that. But when we look closer, we see thoughts do arise and do pass away. But tell me, where do they come from? And where do they go to? So it is not up to you. We hear of the natural and wondrous. It is not a matter of delusion and enlightenment. This wondrous Dharma, wondrous also meaning strange and weird and incomprehensible, inexplicable, incomprehensible. The other reading from this morning, all things are naturally amazing beyond description. And so here at the juncture, subject and object meet each other. The self meets the self in the form of the sound of the fan. Self meets self in the form of aching back, in the form of ease and spaciousness. And so our practice is to close the gap. Close the gap between ourself and ourself, to jump all the way in. To jump into the fire. To open our heart, and this is truly our practice, this practice of love. And of course, we can't do it. And of course, there is nothing but this. So we practice opening our heart. We practice seeing what happens if we stop planning, if we stop the incessant following of the mind. We don't have to stop our thoughts. We don't have to stop anything. This intention to be present to what is here happens regardless of the content. So as you may find yourself falling into, tumbling into, wandering into places of ease, places of settling, the work in these places is to meet, to be with what is here, to not turn away. And when we encounter the places of confusion, when we begin to see that the person who we thought was different is us in the form of, when we begin to see that other human beings in this world are not treated as we are treated, that all of us live in a world of fantastic privilege. And indeed, it takes an act of imagination to actually realize that there are other human beings in the world. We so easily go through the world thinking that everyone else in the world is just some kind of a lesser version of ourself. So this radical otherness of encountering something that is not a construction of the mind, and to see that this radical otherness is not outside of us, but is woven into the fabric of our being. Moment after moment, the universe is born and dies. We imagine that we are the same person. We construct our narrative. I am this kind of person, and here's how it's going. So the invitation is to encounter directly as the mirror of our life whatever happens. Can we allow ourselves to be touched? Allow ourselves to be touched by what is already here. So we take care of ourself, the one who is unwell, the one who is lost, and the one who is lost takes care of the one who is already awake. We take care by coming to the Zendo when the Han strikes. We take care by arranging our bowls silently. We take care of ourselves. We fulfill our bodhisattva vow each time we return. We do our best. The wildness comes and goes. The dullness comes and goes. The internal mother yells at us, not good enough, never good enough. The internal mother says, oh, there, there, sweet one. You're trying so hard. When Danshan was unwell, a monk asked, you are ill, teacher, but is there anyone who does not get ill? Danshan said, there is. The monk asked, does the one who is not ill look after you? Danshan said, I have the opportunity to look after him. The monk said, how is it when you look after him? Danshan said, then I don't see that he has any illness. Thank you. So I invite you to sit comfortably, if possible. And we'll have our Dharma dialogue.
So, you spoke very piercingly about this difficulty we all have in acknowledging that there's anyone outside the self, you know. And I was thinking about that in relation to this wild idea in the koan that the unwell takes care of the well. And the first time Josh read the koan, one of the things that came to me was thinking about moments that I've been acutely unwell, either emotionally or physically. And one of the things that happens, it doesn't last, but one of the things that happens is, you know, you go out, you're well enough to go out, and you're so attuned to everybody else's suffering, and so afraid of causing more, you know. It's, it suddenly becomes the worst thing you can do, because you know it. You know, and I'm thinking about that in terms of, so odd, right, that you don't go into your shell, but this feeling of pain makes you reach out.
I'd like you to be a little more personal.
Yeah.
That, so this is your experience.
Yeah, so odd for me that rather than closing myself up protectively, you know, which you would think,
right,
that's when I really feel that other people are real, and their pain is real. It's as real as mine.
Yeah.
So, I'm thinking that it may be partly because in these moments of acute pain that it gives me this gift of taking away my usual feelings of wholeness and invulnerability, right? That part of you that says, yeah, I'm of the nature to grow old, but really...
Yeah, not for a while.
And no, suddenly, you know, you really are. And so in breaking the self down and breaking the usual, you know, defenses down. So that for I'm understanding that as one way that the unwell takes care of the well.
That's so sad. And I just want to point out, it's not always that way. That people will use pain to build a brick barrier. But I'm glad David encouraged you to talk for yourself, because this is something that you've really discovered. It's a pathway into seeing through the delusion of self and other. And I think that it can be when practice is supporting that. And it can be anyway for some people. Yeah. So thank you for naming that. That was beautifully said.
And when it does become a barrier, it's because we're erecting a barrier to our own pain. Mm-hmm. And then that barrier carries on into barriers to other people's pain. And when we stop with the barrier to our pain, then we are open to the pain of others.
And I think you speak to this disruptive, the noble truth of suffering. And this possibility that as long as it's going pretty well, it's very hard to get out.
Yeah.
That's exactly what I was going to say.
What David said? Oh.
Did you say it in your own words?
I just want to say thanks, Alan, because that helped me see the noble truth of suffering, that it helps break down this vulnerability and, you know, yeah, we're going to get old, we're going to die, but like, not really, because it's me, right? Yeah. But when you're in that state of pain, when I'm in that state of pain, and you can connect to other people's pain, it helps break down that, so it helps close the gap a little bit, and that's why it's noble, and that just clicked for me, so.
Kate?
I really enjoyed your story about the spaghetti. I thought it was interesting how, from you and your brother's point of view, it was great play. And from your mom's point of view, it was a mess and going to cause some work or whatever, you know, bad behavior. And it was the same event, right? But looked at in different ways, appeared differently. Mm. And I was thinking about that in terms of well and unwell. Mm. You know, is there a thing that is well and a thing that is unwell? Is it a matter of how you're looking at it and when? Can you really differentiate?
Yeah. Well, and I think that in the very last line of the koan, where he's talking about, you know, when I take care of the one who's well, then there's no gap. And when there's no gap, there's no opinion. There's just, you know, or just, ah! Yeah. Great, thanks. Okay.
Something came up for me about this well and unwell that surprised me. Actually, a memory from when I was quite small, I was 4, and I was very unwell, and I was put in the hospital, and I didn't know at the time that I was dying, but learned that much later. And I knew something was different, but I really didn't know how unwell I was.
Yeah.
And they put me in it was a big children's ward, and I was in a crib, and they put a net over the crib because it was dangerous for me to get out because of the condition that I was in. But I didn't know that. And I set about to escape.
Yeah.
The girl next to me slipped me a nail file, and I said, I'm serious. She was like 10 or 12, and I started cutting the first I got caught, before they put another one on me. And that what occurred, what came up for me was the, like, I didn't know that I was so unwell.
Mm-hmm.
And what it made me think of today was just not to be so sure about what I know. You know, because how that changed my... Even after that, it was like I still didn't really know how unwell I was. And it changed how I met. I was able to meet my 4-year-old wife. And I could still play games with my dad and, you know, did all the things that... Wondered where my brother was. They wouldn't let him come in to see me. Mm-hmm. I don't know what would have happened if I'd known I was so unwell.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but it just, there was something there for me this morning around that, being so sure that I'm unwell, or that I'm so sure that I'm well.
And that's really what Kate was just pointing to. You know, if you really go to the all the way thoroughly to the end of this koan, and if you were working on it as a koan, this would be the nub of it, right? Well, unwell. You know, what does that? The mind does that. A little 4-year-old, doesn't know. I think of a line from a song: "Little 4-year-old doesn't keep the heart inside." You know, there's just all heart. If any of us have ever known a 4-year-old, you know that. And we've all been 4. Somebody in Doksan was saying, as Doksan is confidential, but so we never mention who said these things, by the way. But someone was saying, you know, the birds and the animals and the trees aren't thinking well and unwell. Right? It's amazing. Yeah, and then we learn. We eat the apple. And then, you know, there we are. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Mike.
I was just thinking that there's kind of a danger here of our role of privilege is the fact that we're not well and able to do something like this and face the benefits of our life in fact what all things have what all contributes to that that it can be sort of a sense of, well, I have this responsibility to fix things for others. And I'm just appreciating this this reminder to you, you know, it's not really about others. It's the risk of others. It's you know, your footprints, you can take care of your foot. It's not really about a sense of responsibility. These other people, and to appreciate Laura's point of not knowing, because, there's sort of a responsibility, but you don't necessarily know what's well and what's not well. You don't know the solution, so I'm pretty much like it. I have this responsibility, I know. So in that difference, I know what's right.
Yeah, it's a very very subtle and tricky point here. And as you're talking, I think of the difference of bodhisattva vow is, here's a bodhisattva vow, I've got to go act it out somehow. As opposed to the bodhisattva vow did not come from the outside and does not ultimately come from the outside. But as we begin to see that it's not just me in this world. I am not just me. I am that tree that's dying. I am this, that then this true identity leads us not to come in from the expert point of view, which is more just adding trouble. But it calls us to something. And calls us not out of the should and it's my responsibility, but of course, I love that. Yeah, if your foot hurts, you don't say, "Well, I did some stuff for you last week." what is this? It's like, of course, yeah, put a Band-Aid, you know, do something.
And I want to pick up on this caring for your foot further. So the reason we know to care for our foot is because it hurts. Because of our awareness of pain. There's a rare neurological condition where people don't feel pain. And that is an enormously dangerous condition. Those people don't live very long. And so numbing ourselves to the pain of the world, not feeling the suffering of our culture, our society, our civilization, our biosphere. This is a very dangerous condition. And it is precisely the pain that calls us back to caring for it.
Yeah. Jeannie and then Christine.
So I don't think it's some kind of ephemeral pain or some kind of theoretical pain. I mean, if when we sit, when we have the privilege of sitting on our year end for a week, we become more and more aware of our pain. And we can call it ours, we can call it the world's. We live in a culture that encourages us to numb out, not notice. And Zen, part of Zen practice for me is not because I have to or because there's a bodhisattva vow, but because I sit down and I shut up. There it is. There's this room in our culture. And, it's mad. I mean, rich people have, alarms on their houses. That's painful. They have to protect what they have. So, that's annoying and painful. right? White people, when I lived in Newark, New Jersey growing up, and when we drove through a black neighborhood, my mother put down all the locks. That's painful as a little kid, you know. You know, and it goes on and on and on. You get used to it, you numb to it. That's ignorance. And when you sit down and shut up, memories come, it all unravels. The pain is right there.
Yeah. And I think this is the courage it takes to do this work. And I think busyness is so endemic, and everyone says I don't want to be so busy, yet we don't slow down for exactly this reason. You know, if I am frantically busy, maybe I won't have to know. So we sit here and we practice opening our heart to whatever comes, and so this great pain can arise, and it can come as images of personal things that float up. It can come up as images of the world, but we encounter this. Thank you.
So Christine, and there's somebody way back.
Yeah, so Christine, and then somebody back in the corner. Jess.
I had the opportunity that I chose to visit Haiti, service work in 2012 with a woman who'd been going there for many years. So the translators and the people that were with us, she was kind of like mom, and we really got to know them. And the unintended consequences, see if I can say this, so just understanding on a physical level of what it means not to be able to bury someone because you don't have the money, and the things where all these caskets were opening, and they weren't shut, and the kids in all these puddles, and just all the disease and the illness. And so what I've been able to do, but it's their unwellness that opened my unwellness that made me well of feeling them as one. I don't know how to put it into words, but about a year ago, someone who I just can feel, it was like I didn't have to try at all to feel his pain. I knew exactly what it meant when he was in these hospitals and his mother was dying, and I knew his father had just died, and I knew how much his mother meant. And that he was also just about to graduate, and then in the hospital when he fell asleep, just trying to get a little sleep, someone stole his cell phone. And so I have a woman who tells me everything that's going on. I experienced that pain as my pain. And I had to do something, but I didn't try, it was just my pain.
Even just now, thank you for that story, Christina. I wonder, there was a moment when you were telling it when your voice started to shake, and then you went off and told us all these details. It felt like there was just what we're talking about. Did you feel that?
No.
Like a little bit of protection. The details,
yes,
are like cotton wool, right?
I didn't know if I could keep joking.
That was a beautiful, heartful demonstration. Thank you for owning it, because... and here we are, right? It doesn't mean that we always have to shake apart and cry, but there's something that we touch that you just showed us, that the story even wasn't that important, but this is important. This is the world on fire. Feeling the pain of others is your pain. It's just what Josh was talking about a few moments ago. And I really, so I'm very grateful, thank you. And I really feel personally that feeling others' pain as our own is essential. It isn't the end of the story, because then we have this Dharma practice that shows us the one who is not in pain. And this is why we have to keep remembering, you know, that it's not, that pain is only, like Laura was saying, pain is just one part of the equation. It's just what I know, this hurts. But there's something else that doesn't hurt. And if you allow that to unfold without wrapping yourself up or, you know, distractions, we, I'm not talking about you personally, when we do that, something unimaginable happens to us. And this is what Josh was pointing to in the very first talk. The heart breaks open. It's not just ouch, but it's oh. It's like ouch and oh together. That's the only way I can think of to say it right now, right?
Yeah.
And that, right, that make, and then laughter bubbles up. What's that? That's not an escape. Laughter can be an escape. That wasn't an escape. It's like a it's, you know, the heart opens and closes. This is it. This is the life we're promising you guys. If you still want to stay for the rest of the session. Yeah.
And this smile and there is something right about letting the pain in, which is what we then, which is what brings us to being able to, this thing that Melissa just drew forth. But it starts, yeah. It starts.
So Jess and then Parm.
That's how you should do it. And so when you're able to actually sit with it and learn to understand what they feel like, that sometimes maybe pulling away is not the thing to do when the pain arises, and sometimes it is, but you need to be able to have something to know.
Yeah.
So I appreciate the opportunity to sit with my pain here and learn more about the difference.
Yeah. Well, and I think you make such an important point about it's so easy to think we're making a rule book. Mm-hmm. Oh, pain comes, I have to jump into it. It's not true, you know. And but there is this getting to know it so that we can make choices that are right for us in the moment. Because sometimes the thing we need to do is just take care of ourselves and you know, be skillful, call a friend, avoid it, turn on a movie. And I think it's so important to name that we are all here choosing, you know, moment by moment, what's needed now, and that unless we know for ourselves, get familiar, we don't know. We just always respond by going away, or some of us always respond by jumping in, and maybe I don't have to jump down the hole again today. Right? So I appreciate you naming the nuance of that and the choice points.
And this practice supports, it enlarges our capacity for this choicefulness. And diminishes our habitual reactivity and gives us these moments in which we're able to choose. So, what is useful here? Do I need to pull away and engage in self-care? Or is there something that I actually am being called to do in the other direction? And having that choice, as David says, is the essence of it.
And just to say that this might sound really great, the reality of the way the skin bag works appears to be, according to the latest evidence, that the reaction just happens. You actually can't prevent the reaction. But you can see the reaction as soon as possible and then make this kind of informed decision. So a lot of Zen practice is regret and shame and, you know, just go, whoa, I did it again. And then you see that that's a reaction. And it, finally, after all the reactions, layers of reactions, then maybe the wisdom of being at a place like this, we've taken away the phone a friend option. We've taken away the go to see a movie option. We've taken the drug option, hopefully, away. There is the snack table. And we're so the limitation that we've imposed on ourselves for this week really gets us to learn what Jess is pointing to. We see the reactivity, and then just what Josh was saying, what David was saying, we get to make wiser choices. But sometimes you have to go through layers of, oh God, not again. Yeah. Thank goodness.
Yeah. Parnell, Carolyn, and close with James.
We seem to be drawing examples in our lives from experiences we have with people who are vulnerable in some way, people who elicit our empathy. People, I'm just speaking personally, I've been in the profession of special education practically my whole life. And also, it's natural for me to think in terms of disability and personal responses to disability. However, what concerns me more, what is more troubling to me, is relating to people who do not appear to have problems. So we seem to be distancing ourselves from an example, but from the people who have the security alarms on their houses.
Yeah.
Then these are other, it's a different type.
Yeah.
I'm concerned because I have a lot of family members in this category, and I got to find some way converse with them. I have a son-in-law who's the president of a UTC company. Do they have alarms on their houses? You bet.
Yeah.
And yet I love them dearly.
Right.
They have no clue what I'm doing this week, and I have no clue how to relate or if or why bother. You know. And yet, it's clear they're not especially happy people. That there is anybody in the world, apparently. I mean, I learned this just since yesterday. I learned it before. That, you know, they got their own sets of problems,
yeah,
and they're not burglars coming in. You know, that's really not the problem.
Yeah.
But there's considerable unhappiness there. And I just feel a need to be careful that we don't create a separate group of people who are privileged, who have everything anybody could possibly want.
Yeah, Parnell, thank you so much for mentioning that, because I think this, you know, the danger of othering is what we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Gina, do you?
Yeah. These five, which is, I certainly was not denigrating people with alarms on their houses, and I understand why, but I was talking about the inherent pain of having an alarm in the house.
Yes.
You know, that looks like a lot of privilege, but in fact, it entails paranoia, it entails the battery not working.
Right.
It's the fucking alarm. It goes on and on.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm just saying that.
Thank you.
Yeah. But, and this point of how we other. And I think especially insidious. So now we're here. Yeah, well, let's be open to people who are poor and people who are not like us. But, you know, some of my best friends are in this other categories. A number of my friends are in the white male educated category.
That's the tough
category. So realizing this is human, this is human beings, this suffering of the world, it is everywhere. It's not just, oh, well, these places here. And then how do we encounter that skillfully and respectfully? So not coming into our friends and saying, well, you should all go on retreat. That's just, I know what you should do. And then, you know, so it's much more respectful, much more what's here. And the other thing I have to say is that I don't believe we can feel someone else's pain. Right? We can feel pain when we're in the presence of someone else's pain. We can feel what it's like to be a human being. But that we have to be so careful and so honest about, so we can imagine in, and it's and so important to do that, but to always respect whoever we're meeting, that we don't actually know what their experience. So your son-in-law, what's it really like for him? You know, and rather than fixing, going back to what Jess was saying about hanging out in this place and wondering, what is it like for you? Yeah, so that's our work, this wondering.
Yeah. I want to just say, because I said that we have to experience others' pain.
Yeah.
So it's a subtle point here.
Yeah.
And I think you just clarified some of the subtlety. So we're not experiencing others' pain with our head. Say, I know what you're feeling. I understand where you're coming from. But there is a quivering of the heart that we call karuna that is, we can only experience it as our pain when we're in the presence of others' pain. But if we fly up into our head and go, I get it. I know what's going on. That's the error that David's pointing out.
Yeah.
And there's a traditional teaching in Zen, in Buddhism, of the six realms of existence. You've all heard this. And they're all problematic realms. None of them are good. And one of them is the realm of the gods. And the realm of the gods is where you have the alarms on your houses. Because everything's really good. But it's going to go. There's fear that characterizes the realm of the gods. Because anything can happen. And we're going to lose it. And actually, that's true. It's only in the center of the wheel that there's freedom. And that's where, you know, a bodhisattva appears in every realm. Three of them are hell realms. One of them is the realm of the gods with the and glass on top of, you know, the cement and all that stuff. Oh, see it everywhere. And then the animal realm, which is the ignorance realm, not the pretty birds flying around. And then there's the human realm, where we try to fix everything. So they're all problematic. And a bodhisattva shows up in every realm to feel the suffering of that realm. That's our job, is to notice when we're in a realm and to wake up in the middle of it.
Yeah. Thank you. Carolyn Richards.
I had forgotten what I was going to say, but maybe it'll come back to me. It was triggered by somebody talking about shame. And also, I was thinking about how much one's own pain and suffering often is accompanied by shame, that you're not supposed to feel that way, particularly if you're white, educated, upper-middle-class, privileged, then your own suffering can feel very shameful. And I recently went through a bad period around illness, hurt, whatever, something physical, and felt very withdrawn. That was what the trigger was. When you were saying that animals don't feel illness, animals hide under bushes when they get sick. They go away to die privately.
But they don't have an image. They don't say,
They don't say, uh-oh, I'm sick.
They have an instinct to go away and be on their own. And so, I think I have that instinct,
which I don't feel good about,
but that's that when I feel sick or really down or something, I feel very inclined to hide myself under a bush. And this last time, and I'm sure it's happened before too, is actually sort of the opposite of what Alan started out with, was that only through taking care of other people in pain and really immersing myself in their experience did I get back to feeling compassion for my own. I wish that came first, but it doesn't.
Yeah.
Later.
Actually, that is part of the traditional teaching for development of karuna, that you first have to look outward because it's hard to look inward. Some people teach that differently, but that's the way I was taught, and I think it's just matches your experience. And a clarification again, so it's not that animals don't get sick. They definitely feel pain, but they don't have the mental cognition, I am a sick animal.
But they do behave differently. Because they cut themselves off from their animals.
But do you see the distinction?
Yes, I didn't mean that they didn't.
It's the head again.
They knew that they were sick, but they do have this instinct to pull away and hide.
We all do.
Find them when they're dying.
Yeah. Great.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen.
So, I think it's so important to... That what we're after here in some ways is this intimacy, this sort of not turning away from the heart of our experience, and that going into that, opening up to that really does, to go all the way back to what Ellen was saying, you know, does draw our hearts together. So as important as it is to go into the darkness in this spot, right? So, forgive the sort of stupid joke of this, but Justin will get this. In the Avengers, one of the things that they keep asking Bruce Banner, like, how he manages to not turn into the Hulk, and in the moment that he turns into it, he says, "My secret is that I'm always angry." Mm-hmm. Right? And so, you know, there's something in here that I've been joking about for a while, that, you know, my secret is that my heart is always broken. Mm-hmm. Right? And that I also don't want to just sell that side of the coin, right? That the other thing that we get punished for as human beings is not just crying, but we get punished for joy and happiness. I mean, mom comes in when you're putting spaghetti through the thing, right? And you're in trouble. Right, and so we learn to also turn away from our own joy and our own happiness, and that's another place to sort of watch how you turn from this, because somewhere in there, right, I'm also always happy.
Indeed. Okay.
Thank you.